Ward and Nate going to pick up Sandy from the airport. He got us there like 2 or 3 hours before the plane landed. We left Crestview before Sandy left Tampa. But he's been hanging around with Sandy for all weekend. He's going to introduce him. Thanks, Bill.
Wasn't quite that bad. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Before I introduce our speaker, I want to tell you something that jumped out at me when I first met him. After we picked him up at the airport, we went and had breakfast. And while we were at breakfast, he kind of pushed away from the table, and he started sharing about his past experience in the military, flying airplanes. And when he did, his eyes got big around. He got a big smile on his face. He started using hand language to, he was talking about doing aileron rolls, you know, going like this, an expression physically. And what jumped out at me was the passion. And I knew that this was something he really enjoyed, something in his past that he really appreciated, he had fun at. And I enjoyed that passion with him because I felt it. I couldn't say that years ago. Oh, by the way, my sobriety date is January 17th, 1986. My home group is Turning Point here in Crestview. But I'm sure we're going to hear some passion in this man tonight. So let's please welcome. He's from Tampa, Florida, Sandy B.
Works.
Oh, that's going to be good. Wow.
There we go.
Oh, we got a clock here. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sandy.
And I'm delighted to be here, and my health is a lot better, but it still helps to sit down instead of standing up all the time. So I hope this works. The microphone's just right, so we'll go ahead. And it's really exciting to be at the first annual, because that's the year that you really take the big leap of faith, and we'll build the stadium and see if anybody shows up. And it's obvious that Crestview is going to have a convention here for many years to come. And I think the pioneers that put it together are really something, because these events, you know, pretty soon it'll be your 25th year. And in the audience will be people who attended all 25. And that's the way these things happen. And it's really exciting because it builds a real history within your community. So I'm delighted to be part of it. My sobriety date is December 7th, 1964, and my home group is the Saturday Night Fever Group in Tampa, Florida. And it's a big speaker meeting, and if you're ever in town, it's got as much energy as you'll find anywhere, so come on over and join us. And I've had a wonderful time. My people that I met, my host, and all of that, it's just been wonderful. So I want to thank everybody. I want to take a few minutes at the beginning of this talk to talk about my daughters, because there's some lessons I want to pass on. And last year, a year ago March, my youngest daughter was murdered on her front yard up in Madison, Connecticut. And 3 months later, her older sister died of alcoholism. So that's a big hit for a family to take. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the experience of people before me gave me a perspective on these events that were invaluable in my own going through the situation, and I just want to pass it on. My youngest daughter was Barbie, had 5 years sobriety. She had a sister who she was staying with, Conway, and she's got about 9 years now. And my oldest daughter, we were trying to get her sober forever. And it just shows when you have your father and two sisters are in AA that when you're powerless over alcohol, you're powerless over alcohol. You can't save anybody else either. And so the lesson really was dramatically portrayed right there last year. What helped me was the example of some other people that I saw along the way. And about 25 years ago, up in Washington, D.C., I was watching the local news. And on the news, a young teenager had been shot that day by another young teenager. And the kid that was shot was one of the kids that goes to school all the time, the really good kid, and he's in a bad neighborhood. And the TV reporter had found the mother of the boy who had just been killed. They stuck a microphone in her face, and they said, "How do you feel about the boy that killed your son?" And she said, without batting an eye and perfectly calm, "I've already forgiven him." And I sat there in utter amazement, because I've been around this spiritual program for quite a while, and I didn't know you could do that. I had no idea that you could forgive as the event is happening. And it opened my eyes, and I used to talk about it with people over the years. I said, "I'll never forget that woman." I said, "That was the most amazing lesson I ever saw." And she was totally at peace except for the loss. But there was, you could see there was no anger, any of that. And then it was, I forget how many years ago, but I'm sure everybody remembered the Amish when they had those murders up there and the family of the boy that was killed. They went over to the family of the boy that did the killing to see if they could comfort them on the same day. And I'll tell you, I don't know about you all, but that really stuck in my mind as opening my horizon to what's possible using our principles. And so when my daughter called me, she said, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "Yes." And then she started telling me what happened to Barbie. And I remembered this woman while she was telling me the story. And by the time she had finished, I had accepted the fact that this had happened and that my relationship with my daughter Barbie was now on a different level. From now on, it would be all memories and stories, but it would still be strong and wonderful. And whoever did it was forgiven. And it just came automatically. And it was an amazing event because I never had to deal with resentment or hatred or anger. I only had to deal with sorrow. And God helps with sorrow, but he doesn't help with hatred. And when you think about it, in these situations, generally the most painful part is because you're so angry and you're so resentful that this thing happened to you. And so it was just an amazing freedom. And the second thing with my second daughter, I learned from the first one that when you get shocking news, there's always a period of time before you react to it. Sometimes you walk over and sit down. Sometimes you get a Bible and you go over and sit down. But there is a period between the time you find out and the time you react. And somebody had told me about this, and so I tried it. I went over and I talked to God, and I said, "God, before I react to this, I want to tell you that this will not affect how much I love you. This will not change how I feel about you as my higher power. You're the most important thing in my life." And I spent maybe a minute in this conversation with God about how this was not going to change how I feel about him. And then I went back and sat down to have the reaction. And guess who came with me? Guess who just, you know, walked over and he just made it again The only thing was sorrow. And that's a difficult thing, but it is just amazing. I didn't know you could forgive that fast. And therein lies, I'm suddenly realizing that acceptance and forgiveness, the real power lies in accepting it immediately instead of fighting that it shouldn't have happened. So I just pass it on because these lessons were given to me. And boy, I'm telling you, in the middle of the real battle, it paid off. So anyway, that's all. I just wanted to get that out of the way. And it's right at the anniversary of all this happening, and I really want to honor them. They were wonderful daughters, and I have a lot of great memories. So let's get back to my story of drinking and how I got to AA and a little bit of the background, and then I have some things about AA that I feel like talking about tonight. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I was born in 1931. I have one sister. She has 33 years in AA, and she still lives up in Connecticut. Wonderful sister. We both were brought up in the Catholic Church. We sat next to each other in the same pew. She fell in love with the place. She thought the nuns were so cute. The Latin was wonderful. Confessional was such a relief. Everything she was taught was wonderful. I, on the other hand, sitting right next to her, thought I was in Auschwitz. I was terrified by everything they taught me. I thought the nuns looked mysterious, and I didn't trust them. And the incense and Latin and the confessional, I knew they were gathering evidence for later when there was going to be, the sentencing was going to occur. And, I just saw everything crazy. And we're both sitting there together. So it's not the church, it's my perception of it, which was totally wacko. But the only real thing in anyone's life is their perception. There's no other reality. That's it. So as far as I was concerned, God was a scary thing, churches were scary, everything was frightening. So I got no comfort from it. My sister still goes there and has loved it all her life. So I just bring that up to show how different two people sitting watching the same thing, how it can be in their lives. The biggest event for me as a kid was World War II. It was amazing. As one comedian said, it was in all the papers. Obviously, it consumed the whole country. And I had uncles, and everybody was involved in the military. We were all involved in how are we going to win? And we were on the East Coast, so there were German submarines, and we had all the blackouts and rationing. And my mother was an air spotter, and we donated pots and pans to the center of town so they could melt them down. But the biggest thing I remember was how united the whole country was. Everybody was together. Nobody had a selfish thing over here or over there. We had this huge common enemy, and it made us put aside our differences, and it was really nice. And it reminds me of AA. I know we think we're nice people, but the thing that's really holding us together is alcohol is waiting out there for us to screw up and to start fighting with each other. And so we kind of keep it together because we have this common enemy, and then we grow to love each other. And so that was my memory of it, and it was just, it was a very spectacular thing. And then we finally had ended, and the veterans all came back, and they went to school under the GI Bill, mass production. We had housing that everybody could afford. All the 50s, how about the cars in the 50s when they came out? I mean, it was just amazing. But there was no more common enemy, so we started dividing up into groups, and we could start yelling at each other. Everybody got selfish again, and so much for that. But my memory is of how united everybody was because of this huge emergency. And that's what made, when I come in AA, I have that feeling that, God, look at us. We wouldn't have gotten along at all out there. And we came in here, it doesn't matter what background, we're all brothers and sisters, and I just love it. Anyway, I was a pretty good student, so I went to a little prep school in New Haven, and it fed right into Yale University, which is the local university. I had worked on the buildings, I was in construction, you know, the townie. And so when I got there, all of a sudden these guys are arriving from all over the country, and I recognized some of them. They were like celebrities and this and that, and I'm going, what the hell am I doing here? I suddenly realized I didn't fit in here. I was in the wrong social class to be in with these guys. So I felt very uncomfortable. I had a hard time getting along and feeling the same as the rest of them. And I wasn't drinking because I wanted to try out for athletics and I wanted to keep getting high grades. So I had gone about 2 months without drinking, and I'm in college and people are going, you're not drinking. Geez, it's amazing. You ought to drink. It's a lot of fun. No, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait. But it finally, one night, I was at a social event. We're supposed to meet each other. I walked over to three or four people, and I could tell from their eyes that they didn't want to know me. Sometimes you don't have to ask people. You can just look at their eyes, and they're going, get out of here. I don't want to know you. And, oh, okay, okay. Turned out no one in the room wanted to know me. I said, well, the best thing to do when that happens is to leave. And I started to leave, and they had a bar there. And I said, well, maybe it's time to have one of these drinks everybody's talking about. So I had two drinks, and I was starting on the third one. And I decided that alcohol didn't work because it didn't make me feel good. I just felt exactly the same. So I turned around to walk out, and everyone in the room wanted to know me. They were all waving at me, would you please come over and be my best friend? And I looked, and everybody's eyes were warm and friendly, and they just could hardly wait for me to get there. I didn't know where the hell to start. And as I started over to the first group of people, I suddenly realized they were right. They would be lucky to know me. And all my anxiety, all of that stuff disappeared, and it was almost like the real me finally got out of the box of anxiety and fear, and I could just be myself. And everywhere I went, I intuitively knew what to say. Oh, you're from Wisconsin. Oh, the Badgers. Hey, yeah. Oh, yeah, Alabama. Oh, yeah. I was just talking. Then they started to go home probably an hour later. I said, where are you going? Right off the bat, I'm going, where are you going? We're just getting started here. And eventually, they're all gone except me. And I went there, went back to the bar, and I said, man, if three drinks did that, I wonder what 20 drinks might do. So on the first night, I found the whole package. I had, I don't know, as many as I could hold. I went back to my room to celebrate this new feeling, and the room started spinning, and I started throwing up, and I spent the night lying on the bathroom floor, camped out next to the toilet, dry heaving, sweating, headache, and it lasted all night. And finally in the morning, I'm on the edge of my bed just wondering if I'm going to live. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And it was like a half a second, and I went, yes. I said, this dying and splitting headache and feeling like your guts are going to come out is a small price to pay for what I had last night. So what I had last night was big in my life. And that's why I'm an alcoholic and the other guys are social drinkers. Because when they drank, it made them feel pretty good. When you and I drink, it makes us feel beyond wonderful. Pretty good, I wouldn't die for. Pretty good, I wouldn't give up athletics, studies. I wouldn't go to jail. I wouldn't get in fights. I wouldn't almost die for pretty good. But beyond wonderful, that's another story. So it's what alcohol did for me that made me an alcoholic. It transformed my reality, and it was worth any price to get there. I didn't know I had made that decision, but that was, from that moment on, alcohol was number one. I would get through the studies and everything, but boy, as soon as it got close to 4:30 or 5, now the day really begins. And I'd go in and start drinking, and so there went the high grades, no more athletics. I'm getting in fights. I barely graduated. Years later, I looked at my record, and I went, oh, my God, I was within 1/100th a point of flunking out. It was just awful how low the grades were. But I did make it. And the draft for the Korean War was still on. So a bunch of us were sitting around drinking beer, and we said, oh, we got to go in the military. Why don't we go down and join the Marine Corps? And I said, yeah, let me finish my beer. So we finish our beers and we go down to the recruiting office, and the recruiting guy must have been, he must have been going like this. Oh boy, five at once. So we went in, yes sir, and we signed the papers, and I had met this lovely woman, and so we got married, and I went off to join the Marine Corps. And it was a rude shock. The introduction, the Marine Corps has a funny way of greeting you. They want you to let you know that this is going to be different. And so I got over that shock, and then it was about 6 months to be a platoon leader, but I saw movies about pilots, and that caught my eye. I'd never been in an airplane, but that looked cool. So I signed up for flight school, and my bride and I flew to Pensacola, Florida to go through flight school. And I got airsick on the DC-3 flying to Atlanta. I got airsick flying over to Pensacola. And then when I got in the SNJ, the first five flights, I had to clean the cockpit out when I got back. And things were looking bad for this guy. But the motion sickness went away. And all of a sudden, I was doing extremely well. And I would be number two or three as we went through basic training and night flying and formation flying and carrier landings and all the stuff that you do. Then I went down to Texas for advanced training and got into jets. And then I got assigned to a fighter squadron over in Japan after some further training in El Toro, California. And when I got over there, the war was over, and I'm in a squadron, and these guys are so cool. I just loved it. The CO of our squadron was a lieutenant colonel called Trigger Long. And he had been an ace in World War II and in Korea. And so it was just such a great thing. And there was a couple other guys, a couple of our majors were also heroes from Korea. And I'd been in the squadron about 6 months, and we were drinking with the colonel, and we said, Colonel, where'd you get the nickname Trigger? And I assumed it was from shooting down a lot of Japanese and actually Russian airplanes. And he said, oh, I got the nickname when I was in basic school. I was up in my room screwing around with a .45 pistol, and I accidentally fired around through the floor above and almost killed the guy above me. So they gave me the nickname Trigger. So it had nothing to do with all his flying exploits. It was some embarrassing thing. And I had a lot of fun. I just was so swept up with the excitement of this and being on a team. It was just wonderful. And about 9 months into it, we were practicing to go aboard the carrier. When I was out in the end of the runway with the maintenance officer, and we were watching our buddies practice. You practice on the field before you go out. And we're criticizing too low, too fast, too high, blah, blah, blah. And he turns to me and he said, I want to tell you something. He said, I'm going to get promoted soon to lieutenant colonel. I'm going to get my own fighter squadron. And I want to get nothing but the best pilots. And I want you in there. Now, I'm a young lieutenant, and this guy's pointing at me. And I'm going, whoa, this is cool. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. Now, this is a guy I'm getting drunk with all the time. And I did not understand. Why would he say that? Now, I didn't ask him. I did not want to hear the answer to that question. Why did you say that? But it was the first time anyone ever said anything about my drinking. It wasn't until I got to AA that I realized an alcoholic's drinking scares heavy drinkers. Do you follow what I'm saying? They're just messing around getting drunk all the time. They don't know what we're doing. We're taking it to another level, and they can see it, and they're going, wow. And that's what I was doing. I'm with guys that are partying, and they're doing all that, and they're looking over going, what is he up to? And that's why he brought that up. So even with these guys that are, they were partying, they were drinking more than normal because they were overseas. And when they came back home to their families, they cut the consumption back. Mine never, it never got cut back. I drank one drink, and then it was up to the drink to decide when I sobered up. And so I came back and did the best I could, but the disease is progressing, and I had a wonderful assignment with the 1st Marine Division, and then I was a flight instructor, and I ended up in a photo squadron at Cherry Point. And 14 years had gone by, and I had gotten a regular commission. I was making a career. We had 6 children. And on the outside, it looked like everything is wonderful. But on the inside, alcohol is now about to make its final statement. It's going to tell me who's boss. And in this photo squadron, it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had the, we were looking at these planes in the museum yesterday, or Friday. Yeah, yesterday. And we were flying the F-8 Crusader, which is a photo plane, but we also had a radar plane, which was an old night fighter from Korea. And I sort of came to. It was a Sunday afternoon, and there was 4 of these F-3Ds, 4 of these radar planes. And they're easy planes to fly. They're straight wing, and there's a radar guy over on the right side, and I'm on the left side. And I suddenly realized that I had to get out of that plane now. I don't know if you were ever anywhere where you just had to leave. I remember one time I was getting a haircut, and I just said, I'm out of here. And he said, well, I'm not through. I said, yes, you are. I'm leaving. It's a combination. You feel like you're going to pass out. You might be going to have a seizure. Something awful is going to happen. Well, that's how I felt. And I said, I'm going to get out of the plane now because I got to get out before I can't get out. And I had done that flying the Crusader. I would, when it would hit, and I would have the ejection seat handle, and I'd fly with one hand on that and fly the mission. And in this plane, they didn't have an ejection seat. It was a crazy arrangement where you pulled up a slide back here and there was a slide that went down. You went out the bottom. And I wasn't sure I even remembered how that worked. I remember partially paying attention when we were getting a briefing on that, but I said, I'm never going to jump out of this thing. So now I'm really looking at the panel back there and I went, oh, this guy doesn't know how to fly. I can't jump out of this plane. So, I mean, my heart is just racing, and so I called the flight leader, and I told him we had an oxygen emergency. And if you do that, you have to land right away because it could be contaminated, and then both people could pass out right away. So the flight leader spotted an Air Force base nearby, and he called them and said, we're coming in to make an emergency landing. We have oxygen trouble. So as soon as you let down, then there's no more problem. We landed. I went over to the officers' club, had a few drinks, calmed down a little bit, and I said, yeah, that oxygen was a little bit of a problem, you know, and so far, so good. The next morning, I walked down to the flight line, I took a look at the airplane, I turned to the flight leader, and I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. Alcohol just decided my career was over. That was it. And he said, what? I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. Why? I'm not going to fly anymore. I wouldn't say anything besides that. So somebody else flew the plane back. I don't really remember exactly. I got back and I had to go see the colonel. And he said, Sandy, what are you talking about? The Frank told me you're not going to fly anymore. I said, that's right, Colonel, I'm not. Why? I'm just not going to do it. I would not elaborate. And he said, okay, well, then I'm going to have to contact headquarters, Marine Corps, and they're going to have to give you a new assignment. You can't be a pilot anymore. I said, fine. I mean, I love flying. This was my whole life, 14 years. And I just said, I'm not going to do it anymore. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and there was no alcohol programs in the Navy. And so they were on their own, and I was on my own. So it took about 2 months to get the orders, and during that time, they had me do the legal work. I did the court martials. I had my own little office. I would not make eye contact with any of the pilots. That all I felt was shame. And I said, I know they're looking in and they're going, who let that piece of crap in this outfit? This is a very special outfit. All captains, no lieutenants. Lieutenant colonel, a couple majors. And I just wanted to get out of there because I did not want to look at any of these guys. And finally I got my orders and I went off and I had another assignment for about a year. And then I had a grand mal seizure, and I ended up in a nut ward, and I was there for 6 months. And eventually, when it came time to get promoted to major, I didn't make it, and then you have to leave. So I ended my career with about 15 and a half years. But you just leave. You don't retire. You have no benefits, and you're gone. About 2 years ago, I was out in the Brentwood Group in California. It's a great AA format. The meetings out there are really big. This one has 500 people. And the format is they get an old-timer like Chuck Chamberlain used to be there a lot. And you go up and you tell a little bit about yourself, but then you pick a topic like surrender, humility, whatever you want. And you talk about it for 25 to 30 minutes, and then people raise their hand and ask questions. I would love to have been there when Chuck was there and raised my hand and asked Chuck questions. He'd give the deepest answer. You wouldn't know what he was saying, but it was, and then 20 years later, you'd get it. That was what it was like to be around Chuck as far as I was concerned. You knew it was deep truth, but you weren't sure exactly what it was. And so before the meeting, a woman was coming to get her 30-year medallion. Some of you have heard this, but I really love the story because I just saw the guy 3 weeks ago. And she told her husband, who's not in AA, he was driving her up to the meeting. She said, yeah, this guy Sandy Beach is going to lead tonight. And he said, was he a pilot? And she said, yeah. She said, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here. So I went out in the parking lot. I've never seen this guy in my life. And he looked at me and he said, in 1962, you were in a flight of four F-3Ds on a cross country coming back to Cherry Point. You declared an oxygen emergency. All the planes had to land and you never flew again. And I went, wow, how'd you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. So, what are the odds on that? And it turns out it wasn't a radar guy. It was another pilot. There had been a hurricane coming towards Cherry Point. Whenever there's a hurricane, all the planes fly somewhere safe. And then you drink until the hurricane goes away. And then you fly back. So there wasn't any radar guys going on that. It was going to be all pilots. And the reason I didn't remember him was he had been recalled from American Airlines during the Cuban Missile Crisis back to active duty. And his name was Jim Heth, and he retired as the second senior pilot at American. And so I said, God, Jim, I didn't know any. He said, where are you going to be tomorrow? And I said, I'm going to be at a conference in Oxnard. So he came up with photographs from the squadron. He had all the blanks that I couldn't remember who the people were and all this stuff. So it was just an amazing experience, but here comes the best part. He said to me while we were sitting alone, we had just looked through all the pictures, and he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? It broke everybody's heart that you were leaving. The colonel went nuts trying to find a way to save you. And we couldn't find it. There was no alcohol program. There was no doctor to go to. And when you left, we felt that we had failed you. And I sat there and I was almost crying. And I said to myself, that's not how I remember it. And I decided that his version was correct. And my version was wrong. My point is, I went back to 40-some years to change the past and put the truth in. And when I put it in, I felt much better about it. Now I can think about that incident in my life, and I have a very comforting feeling about the whole thing. Had I not met him, I would have been left with my old ideas about the situation. And that's what we are stuck with until we take the actions in the program to evaluate all of our old ideas and where we can get rid of the ones that aren't true. And when we do, we transform our past. We just transform it. And in many cases, our parents turn out to be much better than we thought. I guess my mother wasn't that bad. That happens to all of us. I guess high school was better than I thought. I guess this was that. And I remember a speaker, he had a funny way of starting his talk. He would get up and go, "Hi everybody, my name's Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My story is divided into two parts. What happened during the years that I drank, and what I thought happened during the years that I drank." And we can make that statement about our entire life. My childhood is divided into two parts. What happened when I was a child and what I thought happened when I was a child. My perception. So when we come into AA and they're telling us old ideas avail us nothing, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about most of your old ideas are probably wrong. Now, alcoholics don't like to be wrong, even if it would make them happy to be wrong. No, I'm going to stay, I want to be right and miserable rather than wrong and happy. So we hold on to old ideas like, I don't know why, until they're forced out of our hands, and then we feel the wonderful joy of being wrong and letting the truth come up. I mean, look how strong the language is. The idea that we can drink like other people has to be smashed. You remember that? Well, all of these ideas have to be smashed. They just aren't valid. And they constitute the entire reality. When you ask someone what their life is, it's their ideas in their head. And that's the only thing that we have to deal with. I remember somebody gave a talk, and when she finished, somebody said, "You know her, she lives in her own little world." Did you ever say that about people? "You know him, he lives in his own little world." Well, so do you. And so do I. Everybody lives in their own little world. And that's the world that we can go in and change and transform. The only building material of that world is ideas. That's the only thing that's it. And I put together a world full of ideas, and they're my ideas, and that's where I lived. Chuck Chamberlain had this wonderful thing in his new pair of glasses where he would draw a circle, and this is the universe, and then there's me. Outside the entire universe. Anybody relate to that? There's the entire universe, and then there's me. It's almost like saying, God is everything. Remember that thing in the big book? God is everything or he's nothing. Okay, God is everything. And in addition to everything, there's me. Do you see how stupid this is? But that's where we all were. In addition to everything, there's me. I exist in addition to God. Really? How do you do that? How do you exist in addition to God? Very simple. I make up a story that I exist separate from everything, and then I believe it. There it is. That's how you can be separate from God. Conscious separation from God. How could you be separate from God? Oh, I just decided I was separate, and then I believed it. So conscious contact consists of smashing the idea that we are separate in the first place. And the whole program is let go and let God. And what we're letting go with is all our ideas about how everything is. We have this, I call it a web of ideas, and we put them together one at a time since we're little. I don't like him. That's a scary place. And then I'm in the middle, and I go in there, and I'm in charge of everything. It's my own little room. I got a little throne there. There's just me, and it's lonely as hell, but it's mine. And I know there's no God in here, and I could take a lie detector test. Sandy, is there any evidence of God? Nope. And I would pass the test. Nope, there's no God in here. There's just me. And we wonder why we feel lonely at times and why life is so threatening and so difficult. And there I was. So in a way, this guy really smashed an illusion from 1964, whenever the heck it was, 63. So I bring this up because it captures the essence of spirituality. The first time that you're wrong, I don't know about you, but the first time I got my sponsor trapped me into a corner. You know how they are. And I'm going, no, Bill, for God's sakes. And then he goes, no, you know, and he's sober and I'm foggy, so he wins. And I had nowhere to go, so I said, all right, you're right. You're right. And he said, no, you're wrong. And I said, well, it's the same thing. Well, let me hear you say it. Holy cow. As hard as I tried, it came out like, I'm wrong. You could barely hear me saying it. I thought maybe the whole thing would collapse down if I ever said I was wrong. And now I'm like Chuck. You remember Chuck used to say, uncover, discover, discard. He loved it when he found something else he was wrong about. He just loved it because he just couldn't throw it away. Why operate with wrong information? Why operate with untruths about ourselves? And so sobriety really consists, when we say let go and let God, what we're letting go of is all of our ideas. All of these things. We start out letting go of alcohol. It's almost like we got a death grip on all of our life. Now, I'm in charge of this. Okay, sex. Okay, making money. Okay, hating people. This is hate. I got that. That's me. I'm not letting them off the hook yet. And you got like this. And we come along, and alcohol is almost going to kill us, so we get one finger pried up. Alcohol we let go of. I really believe in letting go and letting God. Well, you got nine fingers. You're still like, oh, yeah, but I'm getting around to it. And I'll tell you, to get these other stuff, the biggest action verb in AA is letting go. It sounds like it should just be beep. But you all know it's not. It's really hard to let go absolutely. We just want to control something. It's almost as if I created my world. It's the entire United States. And my alcoholism, I gave up New England. But I'm not giving up Texas, and I'm not giving up California. And it turns out AA, it's a very sneaky program. It's much more extreme than the advertising would let you think. We have some suggested steps. Come on in. I don't like God. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. I don't like prayer. Don't worry about it. Just come on along. Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you're going to be doing the whole deal. So I finally gave it, you know, I got through and I'm sober and I'm doing this and my sponsor's working with me at the Marine base at Quantico. And he said, call me in one night. And he said, well, now you're sober about 3 months. And I want to point out something. I see you reach into the petty cash thing every so often and grab about 40 bucks and never put it back. That's called embezzling. If you get caught doing it, the colonel sees you doing that, you're going to go away for a long time. So you have to stop embezzling if you want to stay sober. So I went home and I went, ha-ha. So you have to not drink and not embezzle. There's two things to this AA. No drinking, no embezzling. Okay. You know, a month later, he's going, you know, I see you flirting with those girls at work. You're married. You want to have a happy marriage. You cannot be messing around with any other women or you won't stay sober. I went home and I said, so there's three things involved. No drinking, no embezzling, no messing around. Every month. You know, a few years go by and I'm on item number 196. I call that false advertising. It said you come in and you just not drink. That's the whole deal. Well, it turns out, for those of you that are new, I hate to tell you, but it's actually you not drink and you change everything there is about you. It's basically that simple. And so I ended up doing the whole deal. I ended up doing the whole deal because there was nowhere else to go. And I ended up having a spiritual awakening. And I ended up seeing the world entirely different. And when the world looks fair, it's easy to be nice to people. And the world always looks fair if you're connected with your higher power, if you're undisturbed, if you're at peace with yourself. And when we're not at peace with ourselves, it looks like the world is turning on us. But it's not. We just see it that way. Chuck's called it a new pair of glasses. I think he got it from Father Dowling. He said, sobriety is like a new pair of glasses. You take all the actions, and finally it's your turn. They call you up to the front of the room, and they say, those glasses you're wearing are called life sucks glasses. You're not allowed to use those anymore. Put them down here. We're going to give you this pair. And you put them on and you look around and it's like you went in the fourth dimension of existence. You just look around, you go, wow, look at this. Everybody's great. And you go over to the dry cleaning place. Hey, how you doing? And they go, geez, I'm so sorry, but your suit won't be ready for your daughter's wedding. Don't worry. I got another suit. I'll be back next week. Take it easy. Don't worry. And you leave and they go, holy cow, I never saw a customer do that. Now go in there and when you're not in fit spiritual condition and see how we treat the person in there. And so this is the wonderful thing that happens. But we're human beings, we're self-centered, and we're never going to reach perfection. So every so often we're sitting at home. They didn't take the life sucks glasses away from us. They told us to take them home and throw them away, but we put them in the drawer. Just for old time's sake. And every so often we go, well, this is great. These are really great, but let me see what it's like with these. Oh, God. And that's what life is like. We just love to go back and have problems. It's almost, if you don't have a problem, you don't exist. What do you share with people? How's it going? Oh, God, you're not going to believe what happened. You're not going to... You know, you go to a discussion meeting. I mean, what do you just go, oh, yeah, I got a topic. This is, that's going on. Oh, man, that's just terrible. I mean, what if we were all spiritually connected? Let's go around the room, see how everybody's doing. I'm doing great. I love God. Pass. Okay, how about you, Mary? I'm doing great. Love God. The discussion meetings would be very boring, wouldn't they? They're so... So this is the fun that we have. We have to deal with our two selves. And that other one, the one, the ego, I'm not mad at my ego. He wants to go back to God just as much as I do. He was assigned the role of spoiler. His job is to screw up my serenity as often as he can, and my job is to try and stop him. And so I just laugh at myself on how I want to go back and find something wrong. And in the 10th step in the big book, after the promises, and it says we've entered the world of the Spirit. Well, the promises, when you get to the end of the promise, there's what I call a spiritual awakening. It says we suddenly realize that God is doing for us. Realizing God is really... And so at that moment, Bill is able to say, we've entered the world of the Spirit. And what that means is we're not going to live by the material world's rules anymore. We're in the spiritual world, so we're going to live by the rules of the spiritual world. So he goes on to tell us what these rules are. This is how you operate in the spiritual world. If we get disturbed, resentful, frightened, excited, you remember that? We ask God at once to remove them. Any questions? That's it. Everybody got it? That's the plan. And I remember going, that's great. Oh, it can't be that simple. It can't be that simple. I'm just going to ask God to remove it. I think it needs some of my help in there in addition to God's, I think. And so the reason I bring this up, we go to a discussion meeting. Somebody brings up, I have a resentment. Something happened at work. And we go around the room and everybody shares what you do when you have a resentment with somebody at work. No one says we turn it over to God. We go, well, when I get a resentment, I like to go work out. And I try to get a lot of energy and get rid of the resentment. And as a result of that, we get 20 wonderfully original ways of dealing with resentment, leaving God out. Isn't that fun? This is our nature. Yes, I know God can do it, but I'd like to see if I can do it without him. And I'll call him as a help of last resort. And first things first is trying to suggest to us, why don't we use God first? And that's the mystery question that we can all ask ourselves. Why don't I use God first? Why do I want to see if I can do it alone first? I remember at one time thinking that if I worked and God helped me so that I felt comfortable in my own skin, so that I felt confident that the spiritual life had finally succeeded and placed me in a position of strength where I don't need God anymore. That is the problem in the spiritual life. It makes us feel like we're no longer as desperate as the day we came in. And I submit to you, we're exactly as desperate. We on our own are going to accomplish nothing. And through repeated humiliations, we finally realize if God isn't holding us up, we're going to fall. And so I'm wrapping it up now for those of you that are new. It's been fun coming up here and laughing about our program, finding the fun in being wrong, kidding ourselves, which is the great bit of humility. And someday you're going to be laughing at yourself. And the reason you're going to be laughing at yourself is it's over. It's over. you are abandoning the old ball game and you're going to join everybody in here. And when you do, you're just going to feel 10 pounds lighter. And people are going to start saying, Ralph, you look different. Mary, you look 10 years younger. Something has happened to you. These are people outside of AA. Are you on a diet? Are you joined a health club? And what happened is your spirit just got on fire. And it's lighting up your eyes. It's lighting up your whole being. And your job is to just keep the flame going. It is going to be the most exciting journey you ever dreamed of. You have no idea what's in store for you. But when you're back here 10 years talking about it, you'll be telling the next newcomer, do not leave here. A miracle's about to happen. Thank you all very much. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Sandy.
Good to see you. Thank you.